yes, eight. Michael J. Hogan, representing Care Concepts, Inc. Mr. Hogan.
Yes, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, counsel, my name is Michael Hogan. I represent the petitioner defendant in this case, Care Concepts, Inc., which is a nursing home which incorporates an Alzheimer's unit. The facts in this case are such that the plaintiff was also a patient in this Alzheimer's unit, who was allegedly injured by another patient in the Alzheimer's unit, who I will refer to as DD. It is alleged that while Sylvia Crawford, the plaintiff, wandered into DD's room, she was struck or pushed down, causing her injury. This is an unusual case for the court, because it comes to you essentially as a discovery dispute from an interlocutory appeal at the Court of Appeals for that. At the trial court, the plaintiffs proffered interrogatories and requests for production of documents to Care Concepts and asked for information concerning whether DD engaged in conduct towards an employee or resident which caused or reasonably could have expected to cause pain or physical injury. And secondly, whether DD engaged in conduct which had a tendency to cause a disturbance. It further asked for the request for documents which would have incorporated the medical chart of the nursing home. It is important to note here in this circumstance that DD is not a party to this case and has not consented. There is nothing in the record to say that DD has consented to the disclosure of her medical records or to the information related to her treatment.
Counsel, what do we do with what I understand is the status before us of this case? That is, we have, as I understand, interrogatory 4, 5, 6, and 7.
That's correct.
Now, at the bottom of those, of all of the interrogatories, there was a request for production of documents, and the request essentially asked for documents relied upon in answering the various questions. Technically, it seems to me, as I looked at the record, we don't have before us the request for production of documents. As I look at the record, the issue preserved for appeal is, or brought to appeal, are the issues 4, 5, 6, and 7. Am I correct?
Well, two things. One, I think it, it falls to the reasoning of the Court of Appeals, I think, is indicative of a disclosure of medical records. But more importantly, the interrogatories themselves ask for a summary or a description of what has happened in the medical records. And as the Court of Appeals has said, to require the disclosure of a summary or of portions or description of what is in the medical records is tantamount to disclosing the medical records. So I think we reach the same issue regardless. The court ruled in this case that interrogatory number 4 was discoverable and because there was no expectation of confidentiality for this type of conduct. And number 6 remanded to the trial court with respect to the question of whether conduct which had a tendency to cause a disturbance was discoverable requiring in-camera inspection on those. Now, my approach here is threefold, and I'd like to take a little tact different from what I took in the brief, because I think it makes it a little more manageable, at least from my perspective. There are 3 points. The first point is that with respect to the medical records themselves, these are medical records which are protected under Section 146.82 of the Wisconsin statutes, which states that no records are to be disclosed without the consent of the patient, except for specific exceptions named in the statute. There is no exception which covers this, and therefore the general statement of 146.82 applies, that no medical records are disclosable. The second point is, as I stated to you, Justice Bradley, that to request or to summarize the record, or for that matter, to ask nurses' memory of their of the record itself, is tantamount to disclosing the records under Section 146.82. The third question, then, is not pertaining to the records themselves, but the question of whether DD can deny authorization for healthcare providers to disclose their observations of conduct and dissemination of that information, since it is privileged, the physician-patient privilege, under 90504.
Counsel, it seems to me, if this is the way you're setting it out, I note, if I recall, the last 5 pages of your brief were dedicated to 146.82, and the first 20-some to the 90504 issue. Are you changing in oral argument your emphasis now? And number one, and number two, do you think the statutory argument of 146.82 is stronger than the 90504 argument?
No, I think the 90504 is more problematic. I think the 146.82 is pretty clear, and I think the Court of Appeals was clearly mistaken when it just categorized the privacy of medical records as nothing more than what falls under 90504. And these are two separate pillars that protect the privacy and the confidentiality of a patient, both from the standpoint of the records and from the standpoint of the communications and the conduct of the patient that is observed by healthcare providers. And so I think it makes it easier because it seems to me obvious that the medical records themselves should be protected.
Are healthcare records under 146.82 defined?
They are, and if you'll look at 146.81, it defines at 146.81, paragraph 4, means all records related to the health of a patient prepared by or under the supervision of a healthcare provider. In 146.81, a healthcare provider includes a nurse who is a licensed nurse, registered nurse, but it also makes reference, as Judge Rogensack pointed out, that it makes reference to an inpatient healthcare facility as defined by 50.135 parent 1, which is a nursing camp home such as Care Concepts. So therefore, a nurse is a healthcare provider, and the facility is a inpatient healthcare facility as defined by that statute. And the records are all those related to the health of a patient prepared by or under the supervision of those healthcare providers.
Well, now, if the patient strikes another patient or an employee, you view that as a healthcare record?
What is in the... Well, I think we have to make a distinction now between what is written in a healthcare record and what may have been observed.
Okay, well, okay. Suppose the healthcare record says as of this day, the patient ate or didn't eat, patient did or didn't sleep well, and then it says that also the patient kicked in the teeth of another patient or the defendant or an employee.
I think from the standpoint of the records themselves, it is clearly, there is no exception in 14682 with
regard to
that.
Anything you put in, even if she pet the dog today?
Well, anything you put in, yes, I think so, because there are medical records and there are records that are required to be written, to be taken by statute and by administrative code. But what's important here is that we are dealing here with an Alzheimer's patient. And it is known that an Alzheimer's patient, one of the sequela of that disease, is that these patients strike out. One of the points, the information that is necessary for treatment of these patients are those very observations, that very information about the conduct of the patient. It is similar to an orthopedic surgeon looking at x-rays. This is the data upon which people make decisions about the care and treatment. And so, while I would advocate the larger position that yes, if it's in a medical record, there is no exception. Clearly, in this circumstance, it is something different.
Let's say, counsel, that if I recall reading all this stuff, that in the nursing notes, it's either by rule or statute, that the nursing notes have to contain any report of accidents or incidents, and I assume to the Department of Health and Family Services. And I know specifically Health and Family Services Reg 8319 requires reporting of incidents. Is that kind of a report to the Department of Health and Family Services that may or may not exist in this record concerning assault, concerning alleged assault behavior? Does that kind of report fall within the definition of health care records under 14682?
Well, I don't know whether I can get to that, because what you're talking about there is a separate report to the department, as I understand it. That I am not concerned with that at this point. That's not what is at issue in this case. What is at issue in this case is the records and retrieving information from those records.
Let's say hypothetically there is an existence such a report. And let's say hypothetically that report to the Department of Health and Social Services has no 90504 confidentiality problem and is not included within the definition of patient health care records under 14682. And let's say hypothetically, however, it parrots everything that was in the medical records of DD that is a health care record. My point is, is there any reason that such a record of an incident and report filed with the department is not readily available, even though it may contain health care information?
I can't tell you what the disclosability of that is with the department, so I can't really answer you on that question. I can tell you that in my understanding of those reports, that they aren't the detail of they are the facts that such existed, but I don't think it has the detail of that. But I can't tell you specifically as to whether or not those themselves are disclosable, that information to the department.
It strikes to me that anything that is readily observable by all the other patients and anyone visiting the nursing home, such as assaulted behavior, is not part of a confidential medical record. Now, that may be moved into 90504, but I just can't see how that's a confidential communication or confidential about anything. It's open, public.
No. Okay. And this is, I think, where it gets problematic, if I could. I think there are, when we were looking at the privilege as opposed to the medical records, I think there are several options or a few options, and I'm sure you'll be able to think of many more options as we go along here today. But the certainly an option is one provided by the Court of Appeals, and I think for that is flawed in the sense that it treats 14682 as coextensive with the privilege. It assumes that the disruptive conduct or the conduct of acting out is not part and parcel of the disease, and therefore it assumes that there is no expectation of confidentiality. It looks at the reasonable expectation, the subjective expectation of an Alzheimer's patient who at the time may or may not have any expectation one way or another. To speak of, what the courts have done in looking at the subjective expectation of the patients is in the context of communications and those kinds of cases, for instance, in a criminal case where a statement is made by an accused to a healthcare provider where there may not be, which may not relate to treatment or which in which there may be no expectation of privacy, and in which that patient is perfectly able to reach that kind of expectation, to have the mental capacity to do that. This is not that kind of situation. I think we have to look at something beyond just what is the immediate expectation of the patient, because we're dealing here now not with the language, not with the communication, but with what are the observations of this person's conduct. The Locke case, if you'll notice, referred to, mentions not only the expectations of the patients, but also, interestingly, includes the expectations of the healthcare providers in that, which I find to be very interesting. And I think ultimately what we have to do is look at what would a patient expect when they have their mental capacities, suffering from Alzheimer's, going to an Alzheimer's unit with the expectation that their expectation would be that the sequela of their disease would be confidential.
Counsel, but doesn't the Locke case deal not with subjective expectation, because your argument just makes a lot of sense in terms of someone with Alzheimer's having perhaps any expectation on this issue. But the Locke decision talks about the objectively reasonable perceptions and expectations.
It makes a judgment about whether the actual, as I understand the case, makes a twofold judgment. Was it a perception, and then was it a reasonable perception? So I think, yes, I think it does. But I think we have to look at something broader in this kind of context, because we're talking about people who, at this time, don't have any capability or may not have any capability as Alzheimer's patients. And so the question then becomes, what are the options to draw the line? And quite frankly, that's a tough call. Chief Justice Abrahamson pointed to the issue of what do you do about actions of patients in common areas, for instance, in the dining room. I think that there are two options that the court would take, and I would argue the greater and the latter, but the first option would be to consider, unlike the Court of Appeals, to consider the context in which this conduct occurred. In other words, did it occur in the privacy of the person's own room or in other situations where there may be an expectation or a limitation of that observation of the healthcare provider with the patient. So in essence, to oversimplify it, did it happen in the patient's room away from the common areas, or did it happen elsewhere in the common areas, and draw the line there? And that is an option, and it's neater. It's very neat, and it makes it easy. The problem with that one is that I don't think it takes into account what the true expectations of confidentiality are by family members who entrust their parents who are suffering from Alzheimer's to these kinds of units. I'm sure the families would expect that the sequela of their disease would remain confidential. And
counsel,
yes,
I don't necessarily argue with that, but that would be an expectation that all patients, not only the allegedly offending, but the others whose parents are being, quote, assaulted in some way, would have some expectation that they would know what's going on in that particular facility. In other words, I think that cuts both ways, obviously. So you have the expectation that if an assault happens in a, quote, common area, that they would certainly know about that and be so notified that they would have the opportunity to know.
Well, that's an interesting point, Judge Wilcox, and you have a point, except that I think what we're talking about here is the definition of the privilege. And the only way to reach that definition of the privilege is what is confidential, which gets to what was intended. It doesn't say who intended in the statute, it just says what was intended. And I think ultimately that becomes more of a public policy, a policy concern of this court because of the nature of Alzheimer's patients. I would argue that the expectation of people who have their mental capacity but know that they are suffering from Alzheimer's, and that the families who may place parents in a nursing facility who are suffering from Alzheimer's, clearly their expectation would be, as is the healthcare providers, I might add, based upon their ethical principles, that the conduct which is relevant to medical treatment is privileged and has to be privileged. And to draw the line where I said about public-private distinction, I think begs the question in some ways. One, this is a very unusual circumstance where people are now in a living situation. They have a private room but may eat in common. They may share a room with another one. And I certainly wouldn't want to apply the privilege to someone who could afford a private room versus somebody who couldn't. But furthermore, I don't know that whether something is overheard quashes the privilege, does away with the privilege. For instance, if I were in an emergency room, and in one of those emergency rooms where they draw curtains around you, and I make statements to a doctor, and it is overheard by a third party, I don't think that prevents the privilege from applying as to this doctor being able to disclose communications or the conduct that is relevant to medical treatment. So I think that as a result, this court has recognized the privilege. The Court of Appeals has gone so far as to say that the privilege is so strong in the Schiffer case as not to allow the court to review the records in camera. Unless there is authorization or consent by a victim in a criminal case, the result of which was to dismiss a sexual assault criminal action. I mean, the courts have assigned this privilege as very strong, a strong public policy weight in any analysis. And in the Winnebago County versus Herald, the Court of Appeals stated that it wouldn't even get to the question of whether or not it was material to the issue in a case in which a guardian was challenging his removal of a patient in a civil action because it said the privilege of the patient itself was so strong that they wouldn't even get to that.
If we take your position, it's almost impossible to hold your client liable, ever. Because you put everything in the record. I mean, that may be to your client's interest. But in terms of how the court interprets the statute, you're just closing up any information that's available about this patient.
First of all, we're not closing it up. This is DD's privilege, ultimately. And one option is to seek consent from DD, which, to my knowledge, has not been done in this case.
Well, but DD may not personally be able to give consent.
Well, then the DD's guardian.
Okay, but now why would that be done? Because DD may ultimately be liable. Ian may ultimately have the funds, and your client may or may not have a DD.
Or DD may reach some agreement with the plaintiffs of immunity, of a apparent release for the recent release of the records. There could be all kinds of ways in which this could be done. I hate to be given ideas out here, but it would seem to me to be one option. Also, there is more to it. First of all, this is a very unusual case. Most of the nursing home cases I've seen are wandering cases or fall cases where the plaintiff is the patient who by putting the case and his or her health into issue, has released the records. This is an extremely rare case. I've never seen one like this, okay? So it's unusual.
Well, we had a case where somebody in the nursing home injured an employee.
Right. And Justice Bradley applied the fireman's rule, basically, to this kind of phenomenon.
So this is just the next case of an injury to another.
This is a case of an injury to another.
Discovery into the independent recollections of the healthcare providers is not prohibited by 146.82. That would be governed strictly by the
privilege. As I can tell, yes. Now, when we're talking about the independent recollections of an event, then we're talking about the privilege.
Sure. So the plaintiff is not prohibited from deposing all the healthcare workers and asking about their independent recollections of assaultive behavior. And then the objection is based solely on the statutory privilege in 90504 rather than any resort to the much broader provisions of 146.82.
Right. But now you get to the question of whether there's memory and then the question of is it privileged.
I understood part of your argument that, following Justice Sykes' question, that part of your argument was the observation of the healthcare providers, the nurses, is either communication or, I think, under the privilege statute, information transmitted.
Disseminated
that's
by the statute.
And that it was privileged. And then you gave the hypothetical of the delirium tremor and the hypothetical of lethargy. Yeah.
That's not to say that the records aren't privileged. I just don't also fall under the privilege. I mean, these are two overlapping statutory provisions that provides more protection than either one of them does individually. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Mr. Schomburg, representing Sylvia Crawford.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Phil Schaumer, and I do represent the plaintiff respondent, Sylvia Crawford. Ms. Crawford was a resident in a nursing home, and she was attacked by another resident. We've requested information regarding prior attacks by this other resident. As the Chief Justice noted, that's important to the case here because if there's evidence of prior attacks by this resident and the nursing home knew about it, that can lead to a verdict that they were negligent in not protecting Ms. Crawford and the other residents from this person. The core issue in the case is whether that type of information deserves to be protected and kept out of the case. Courts, many cases have held that courts are involved in a search for truth. I think that's where we get the policy that we have broad discovery. That's contrasted with strict interpretation of privileges because privileges interfere with the court's search for the truth, and that's exactly what we have in this case. The policy behind the privileges involved in this case are that we want patients to be able to freely and candidly discuss their medical concerns with their healthcare providers. Now, the average person does not expect that if they attack someone, that that information is going to remain privileged. And if that's the case, the policy behind these privileges is not implicated in this case. And if the policy is not implicated, it doesn't seem that we should go to extremes to try to protect the information, because to do so would be to actually not be strictly interpreting the privileges, but rather adopting a broad interpretation of the privilege.
Why do you go to this, what the average person would reasonably rely on? Why don't you just stay with the words of the statute that address talk about 90504, that a communication isn't confidential if it's done in the presence of a third person who's not present to further the interest of the patient in consultation? Why do you bring in this expectation discussion at all?
Well, I think that comes into the case because in discussing the doctor-patient privilege, the court in Locke and this court in State v. Jensen looked at the reasonable expectations of a patient, and perhaps average person doesn't necessarily exactly equate reasonable expectations, but that's what I'm getting at. The reasonable expectations of people are not that if you attack someone that information is going to be confidential, because even if somebody is not in that room at that time, other than the person being attacked and the attacker, other people may well be involved and have that information, come upon that information. For instance, police might be called. And if police are going to be called, that information is not expected to remain confidential. Or other residents, visitors, may happen upon the scene. And I think in those situations, you don't have a reasonable expectation that this information is going to remain confidential.
Counsel, I have a question, just one of procedure. You know, you didn't sue DD here. You didn't sue DD. Wouldn't that be something that you would want to do to allow them to assert their, you know, privilege, physician privilege here, physician-patient privilege?
First, I was not the attorney involved in starting the lawsuit, but I think the she clearly would not have understood what was going on.
Guardian, but I mean, as I understand it, as you have your client by June Goodyear, her guardian, you have DD by her guardian, someone to assert her privilege rather than you have care provider here is asserting.
I think we would still have this problem because if they're a party, they even have more incentive not to release the information.
But counsel, I mean, let's try this. You sue DD. DD says, I raise as a defense, I'm not negligent I can't engage in the requisite, there's no negligence here, and it wasn't intentional, or whatever the cause of action against DD is, because of my mental incapacity. And then you say, oh, there's a body of law that says a mental illness, so you're a person mentally ill, you're held to the same standard of negligence. And so she raises, then, assuming it's a she raises this as an affirmative defense, which puts her mental capacity into question, which means then there's no confidentiality if it's a subject of defense, right?
I think that would be the correct way to work through it. And obviously, from the privilege standpoint, that would have been desirable to insert them. I don't think that was a consideration at the beginning of the lawsuit in terms of who to name. I think in terms of those considerations, I think from a practical standpoint, it didn't look like that they were going to be important, and certainly not the collectible party, and I think those were the considerations that went in. Now that we get into this question, obviously that would have been desirable, and it may have been better to have included it right from the outset, but I still think you have to look at, I think those types of considerations suggest that this is not the type of case where we should be saying that this information is protectable, because I don't even think it raises to the level of what's confidential under the doctor-patient statute. And backing up a little bit, we have this relationship between Chapter 146 and the doctor-patient privilege under Chapter 905. And under 146, what you have is an exception, even if you assume that this is a healthcare record. There's an exception to the release of those records if there's a lawful order of the court. Under the plain language of that exception, if this is not privileged information under 905, the court can lawfully order the release, and then under 146, that can be released under that exception. And so the case, in my view, really hinges on whether this information rises to the level that it's to be protected under Chapter 905. And that's where you get this question of what does someone reasonably expect? And I would also add that you also get the question, there's a couple of things that have to be there for it to be confidential information. One, the communication or the information has to be made or disseminated for the purpose of diagnosis or treatment. And then there has to be the fact that it's not intended to be disclosed to third parties. In other words, it's intended to be confidential. You have to ask, who are we looking at when we ask those questions? Whose purpose are we looking at, and whose intent that it not be disclosed to third parties? And that question has been answered in State v. Jensen and the Locke case, that we look at the patient's expectations. And I think that's necessitated by the strict interpretation of privileges, that what are we trying to do with this privilege? We're trying to get patients to freely discuss their medical concerns with the doctors. So it's their expectations that are going to drive whether they're willing to discuss things with the doctors. And when you look at the purpose of diagnosis or treatment, looking at it from a reasonable objective standard, people don't attack other people intending that to be part of their diagnosis or treatment. The reason behind the attack is something entirely different. And furthermore, again, which we've already talked about this, they don't have a reasonable expectation that when they attack somebody, that information is going to remain confidential.
Now, I'm concerned about this reasonable expectation language, because I think it makes the application of the statute fuzzy.
I need your help. I need you to address this, respond to me in this. And looking at Locke, it twice, and you don't have to look at it for this question, it twice makes reference to this reasonable expectation on pages 604 and 605, and just makes the assertion and cites State versus Jenkins. If Locke is correct in its interpretation of State versus Jenkins, it's fine. If it's not correct, then it's got problems, because the only premise for this reasonable expectation and interjecting that into privilege is the cite to State versus Jenkins. And State versus Jensen was a Fourth Amendment case, and as I read it, it seems to indicate, okay, for Fourth Amendment, there has to be, discussed, was there a reasonable expectation of privacy? Then the court looked to the privilege statute and said, oh, because of the privilege statute, there was no reasonable expectation of privacy in the context of Fourth Amendment. But then you get to Locke, and Locke seems to kind of invert the equation and say that whether or not there is privilege depends on whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. So you had, as I understand it in Jenkins, Fourth Amendment needs reasonable expectation of privacy. No reasonable expectation of privacy because there's this privilege statute. They take that, and in Locke, they invert it to ask whether there is a privilege depends on reasonable expectation of privacy. Is that a problem? And why not, if not?
Well, my first comment would be that I'm not sure that that's how the court in State v. Jensen was operating. By the time it asks the question about the privilege, it has already dispensed with the search and seizure issue. And so I think it is looking at the privilege there when it talks about reasonable expectations. But even if it were not, you have the problem that as you look at the statute, it says intended for the purpose of, it had to be for the purpose of diagnosis or treatment and intended not to be disclosed before it gets any protection. Well, it's somewhat ambiguous because you can ask, are we talking about the patient's intent, the doctor's intent, family member's intent? Whose intent are we looking at? And I think when you look at the fact that we just interpret privileges strictly, I think that dictates that you pick the patient's intent because that's all that's necessary to protect the policy behind the privilege. Because when a patient is making a decision about whether I'm going to discuss my medical concerns with my health care providers, they're not interested in other people's expectations. They're looking at what are my expectations about this. And so I think even if this court in State v. Jensen hadn't been dealing with that issue and it was really Locke wasn't properly relying on that, I still think when you look at the policy of interpreting statutes strictly, I think you reach that conclusion. And I think that's a sound one because I don't think it's anything further is necessary to protect the policy behind the privilege. And I think we can see the problem in choosing another route. The nursing home is suggesting here today that, well, we have to take the family members' expectations into view. Well, if we're doing that, we're no longer strictly interpreting a privilege. We're going very broadly. And I just don't think that's the intent when you try to balance broad discovery versus privileges which interfere with the court's search for truth. I don't think you're striking the balance that the courts have said we need to in those two. So I think that's how I would answer that. Even if State v. Jensen wasn't saying that, I think the policy behind strictly interpreting privileges leads us to that conclusion.
But when it comes, counsel, to information that's contained in medical records and the medical records themselves, isn't the scope of the privacy interest legislatively defined by 14682 so that we don't even have to go the route of an individual case-by-case analysis of what the reasonable expectations of privacy of whomever were.
Well, I think you get there if you have a document that's a healthcare record, and for the sake of argument, I'm saying let's assume we have that here. There's an exception for a lawful order of the court.
Yeah, but that has to mean something, and the court in Billy Joe said what it means, and what it means, or a very similar statute in the Chapter 51 context, and the court said what it means is something similar to the statutory exceptions which allow release, none of which apply here.
Well, I think if you look at the reasoning in Billy Joe, the court starts off with a discussion about the purpose behind Chapter 51, and we're dealing with involuntary commitments there, and the legislature has recognized that we have an interest in reintegrating people who have been involuntarily committed back into the community. And the court specifically stated that it was looking at that policy and interpreting the statute in that case. As I read that, the court is deviating from a strict interpretation of a privilege because of an additional policy concern.
But 14682 isn't a privilege. It's a blanket legislative statement that medical records are private, period. End of inquiry. They will be released only under certain enumerated circumstances, none of which is triggered here. If we interpret, a lawful order of a court to mean something consistent with those enumerated exceptions.
Well, I think the way the courts have treated it in the context of litigation is it operates as a privilege. If we look at the city of Mosquito versus Godek, the court is, if 146 was completely separate from 905, the proper reasoning in city of Mosquito would be to say it's not to be released. And end of discussion. But it doesn't. It says, okay, is this releasable under 905? So the way this court approaches the relationship between these two statutes is different than it is approaching Chapter 51, where you don't have the same relationship. I think when you read Billy Joe W., there's a concern in that case that is not present here, specifically to protect the information regarding people that have been involuntarily committed can be reintegrated. We don't have that same situation here. We're dealing with a statute that protects healthcare records in general. And I think when you look at that, I think you have to take the plain language of the statute because you don't have that other policy consideration.
Counsel, I found interesting when I was reading the confidentiality of patient healthcare records, 14682, sub 5. And sub 5 treats records of residents of nursing homes differently. Essentially, sub 5, as I read it, is saying, there are going to be federal or state audits and performance evaluations, and you can, healthcare records then can be turned over to the state agencies and the federal agencies doing all of these audits and compliances. And now we're not talking just about health nursing home, but just forever, all patient health care records. Then sub 5 goes on to say, however, if you're private pay, resident. You can make a signed written request on a form provided by the department to say you don't want your records turned over in these state and federal compliance audits. So private pay is treated differently, except if you're a nursing home resident. What, if any, import should be given to this stat, to this exception of a resident of a nursing home in terms of comment of public policy by the legislature? Is anything to be, of all records, of all sorts of that hold patient health care records, whether it be, an audiologist, or whether it, because the list is very expansive, acupuncturist, social worker, speech pathologist, and we're talking about not just hospitals or medical centers, we're talking about all sorts of health care records that come under the purview of 14682, but they make one exception. What, if anything, do you make about that?
Well, I think it points to the different nature of a nursing home from the typical healthcare situation where a patient goes into a clinic or a hospital and or to some healthcare provider's office for a specific either procedure or office visit. I think it points to the different nature, and so it's recognizing that and then saying, so in certain contexts, what we're trying to do here by protecting healthcare records doesn't apply. But in terms of this case, I'm not sure if the court were to adopt the reasoning in Billy Joe and apply it to here. I don't know that you could say, the court's order in this case, I don't think comes in within sub 5 there. So I don't think this court could say, we're going to release these records or this information because it comes in a specific exception number 5. I don't think that's the case. And if the court were to adopt the reasoning in Billy Joe, you have to look for, before a court can lawfully order the release of records under this section, you have to have the purpose behind the release being similar to the purpose behind the release in one of the other specific exceptions. And while sub 5 may well indicate that nursing homes have different, they work a little bit differently, I don't know that that could get this court to be able to say that that's sufficiently similar to what we're doing here, that the court could release it under the reasoning in Billy Joe. But I think when you look at the plain language of the statute, you say lawful order the court. And in this case, the court's order was lawful because this is clearly, other than a privilege, discoverable information because it's relevant to the proceedings. And I think under the doctor-patient privilege statute under 90504, I don't think it rises to the level that it gets protection there. So under the plain language, I think you can read under 146.82 that it's a lawful order of the court. And I don't think this court needs to adopt the reasoning behind Billy Joe, because I think what led to that reasoning was the policy consideration specific to Chapter 51 that we don't find here. I think the language of 146.82 does provide analysis to it, to this case, other than just the exception. If you look at all sub 1, it says all patient health care records shall remain confidential. And it says that they may be released only to the person designated in this section. Well, that raises an interesting question. When the records or the information contained in the record is no longer confidential, in the sense that it has been disclosed to third parties, and I think you that takes us outside of what this statute is trying to do. This statute is dealing with information and records that are already confidential and to remain confidential. I think that's a fair reading of what the legislature is doing with this. In this case, you don't ever get to this information being confidential, because the reasonable expectations of really everybody, the healthcare provider, patients, person attacked, is that this is the sort of information that's going to be disclosed to third parties, either because police come, because family members happen on the scene, other visitors happen on the scene, and clearly the person being attacked would know about it. And so I think even under that analysis, I don't even think information that wasn't confidential in the first place, I don't think is what was trying to be protected here. Because under that analysis, you could put almost anything in a patient's record and say, well, it's in their record and therefore can't be released under this, but that information might have nothing to do with patient's health care. But once it's in the record, this would seem to dictate that it can't be released. And I suggest that there's two ways out of that. One is that if it's not confidential in the first place, 146.82 doesn't protect it. But the second way is that, take the plain language of the statute, if there's a lawful court order, it can be released. And then I think that leads us to determine that this is lawful. You have to say, is it, does it come under the doctor-patient privilege under Chapter 905? And if it doesn't, which I don't think it does because it wasn't made for the purpose of diagnosis, I think you have a valid court order in this case.
Counsel, Judge Stahlberg in this case, with regard to interrogatory question 4 or 5, that is for inquiring of the assaultive behavior and if it has occurred in the past, and 5, asking for the incidents, didn't say turn over any reports. Judge Stahlberg said answer the question. The question, for instance, in 5 is the date such accident occurred or incident occurred, the names and current addresses of any person, state whether or not any records or reports of incident were prepared by CARE Concepts on its behalf, and describe in detail the nature of the incident. Is there a valid position that can be taken that we don't even need to get to 146.82 because there's been no release, there's no required release of records?
I think that's,
your opposing counsel says no, because really what, you know, that's form over substance, really you're getting information from the records, even though you're not releasing the records. Tell me what you think of that.
I think if this court adopts the approach under Billy Joel, I think you can't. I think you have to treat this as a release of the records if that's where the information is coming. Because in the case of N. Ray Daniel A., the court in a Chapter 51 case following the rule in Billy Joel said you can't just lawful order, the court isn't going to do it. And it looked at the source of the information. Where did it come from?
Yeah, but Billy Joel was a records case. They wanted to get the actual records.
But in the Court of Appeals, in Ray Daniel A., was dealing with deposition questions. And what that court said, under the following Billy Joel in Chapter 51, said you can't depose healthcare mental health care workers about information that they obtained from reading the patient's record. If they have independent recollection, it applies. And I would say in this case, if the court is going to adopt that reasoning under Billy Joel, I think it also adopts the reasoning in Ray Daniel A. and says that, assuming that this information can be that there are healthcare workers that have this information independently, either because they've witnessed it or they got it somewhere outside the record, I think that can be disclosed. But we don't know whether that's the case or not, because I think the nursing home has, up to this point, has argued that, well, we can't get this information unless we resort to the healthcare record. If that's true, and this court adopts the reasoning in Billy Joel, I think, yes, you have to look at 146.82, even though Judge Dahlberg didn't order the release of any records. But I think that even if you do look at 146.82, you don't have to adopt the reasoning in Billy Joel, and you can say that we're going to take the plain language. It says it's an exception for a lawful court order, and that really is looking to whether whether the information is privileged under 905.04, and if it isn't, then it's lawful for the court to order, assuming it's otherwise discoverable, which I think we have in this case. So that's, so I think you do have to analyze it under 146.82, whether or not you adopt it in the reasoning under Billy Joel, because from the nursing home's position, they're saying we can only get this if we look to the records. And I think the common sense says that if that's the only place that they can get it is somebody reading the records, that's the same as getting the records. I think that just common sense would dictate that. I don't know if you could do that. I don't think that that would be what the legislature intended myself. But I think it got to, that's why I think it included under lawful order of the court, so that information that's otherwise relevant to a case that doesn't rise to the level of needing to be protected can still be gotten, because they recognize how broad this is otherwise. So my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schomburg. Mr. Hogan, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, quickly, I would just like to discuss this notion of assaultive behavior that the Court of Appeals referenced. First of all, that is not the language used in the interrogatories. The language in the interrogatories is... whether engaged in conduct towards an employee or a resident which caused or reasonably could have been expected to cause physical pain. The court, and the vagary of this, I think, is important, because what we're dealing here with here is people's actions, people perhaps acting out who are Alzheimer's patients, which is a normal sequela of Alzheimer's. To talk about the leap to assaulted behavior, the Court of Appeals defined that, or at least cited Myers versus Briggs, which talks about assaulted behavior as an intentional act. But the Court of Appeals talks about assaulted behavior either intentional or impulsive. We're not dealing here with an issue pertaining to and an intentional assault. We're talking about people acting out, which is the normal sequela, or can be the sequela, of Alzheimer's. And so I think that vagueness indicates just the difficulty with the Court of Appeals decision.
Now, if I recall, the injuries alleged were that the plaintiff had injury to her face, including cuts, contusions, bruises, and a broken nose, and the complaint said something about the plaintiff prior to this was able to recognize her family members as alleged, and now no longer recognizes family members and is withdrawn, and those are some of the words, I think, of the complaint. I mean, that sounds to me arguably assaultive behavior, and if that, those kinds of consequences, if they existed with regard to other residents?
Assaultive behavior in the sense that there is contact or there is acting out. But I just want to clarify that what we're talking about here is not some kind of necessarily some kind of intentional act.
Well,
we're talking about an impulsive act, which the Court of Appeals has referred to.
Well, what difference does that make as to the liability of your client? Because whether it's intention or otherwise by DD, your client is still liable for the care and protection of other residents against any kind of attack.
Yes. the point is, however, that when you expand this to impulsive conduct, you are now looking at conduct that is relevant to treatment, right? We are dealing now with conduct that is used to evaluate the condition and the mental status and the condition of the patient. And so you're asking healthcare providers to disclose that information, which is contrary to 90504.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's relevant to treatment or whether it's relevant to physical restraints. And I don't know the physical restraints would be treatment, but they would sure cover any kind of lashing out, whether it's impulsive or uncontrollable or negligent or intentional.
Well, I certainly don't think this court would say that the fact of somebody being restrained is not something that, just in and of itself, is not something that should remain confidential. It certainly is a part of the treatment of a patient.
So you would say that any record that said they're keeping them under restraint, either bed restraint or wheelchair restraint, you think that's protected in the record and doesn't have to be released?
In the medical record, are you saying?
Healthcare record.
Sure, clearly, because of 14682.
Well, you see, the problem I have is that you're putting everything into healthcare record.
Well, let me address that, because that's something that Mr. Chambers said,
right.
And I think it's incorrect. This is just because something is placed in a medical record only protects the medical record. The question now is the information that was arrived at. Is that protected under 90504? So to say that we can hide things by putting it in the medical record is incorrect, because you still have the issue of, is this something privileged under 90504? In other words, the independent memory of that, whether the nurse is permitted to disclose what she remembers of a particular event. And that is why we get to, and that's where it gets problematic, is where are you going to draw the lines on the physician-patient privilege? And I'm suggesting that the Court of Appeals is wholly inadequate for the reasons I stated before, and that the other options are to try to draw some public-private distinction, or to look at the reality of what the expectations are of the public, of Alzheimer's patients when they have mental capacity, is that their actions that result from Alzheimer's are confidential. I would advise the court further that when you look at, let's look at the patient's expectations. I think I described in the brief where we're talking about patient's expectations, again, when you're talking about conduct or observations of conduct. For instance, I gave the example of an alcoholic treatment center where a patient is denying alcoholism, but the nurse or the social worker or the healthcare provider observes tremors.
Your red light's on.
I have lots more, but I will stop.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. That completes the arguments on Crawford versus Kidd.